It was 10 years minus 10 days ago, on the 26th of May, 2015, that Dame Zaha Hadid graced the very room that you are sitting in now to open the Investcorp building. It was simply the most exciting moment that brought to culmination 9 years of a project from first conversation till the opening day that had absolutely consumed the hopes, the ambitions, the thoughts, the aspirations of the entire Middle East Center, St. Anthony's community, the city of Oxford, and to no small degree, Zaha Hadid architects themselves. It was a project which was very close to Zaha herself because she was introduced to our community by her late brother, Fulad Hadid. He had insisted that his sister, whom he was so proud, attend seminars here. Judging by the way she worked her BlackBerry, as mobile phones were back in those days, she was less interested in the political and historic debates that activate us in the Middle East Center than was her older brother. But she came with good grace. She could see what was special and interesting and worthwhile about the Middle East Center. And when we invited her to come and give our big annual lecture, our kind of culminating event of the academic year, the George Antonius Lecture, in 2004, she actually accepted and gave us a mind-bending lecture that left our Oxford audience looking perplexed and confused, but as though they'd somehow seen a vision of a future they couldn't quite get their heads wrapped around, but that it confirmed that we were in touch with what was the most exciting current in the creative side of the Middle East, a region that in far too many of our seminars, we dwell on political failings, wars, conflicts, and troubles. Here we had one of the world's leading creative thinkers in the field of architecture come and address our audience with an exciting vision of the future that left its mark. But never did I think, at that point, 2004, that within 2 years I'd be in a position to approach Zaha with the idea of actually doing a building. And many things interfered in the meanwhile. We had the time it took to identify the program for the architects to begin to put together first ideas, to choose of the two ideas that they offered us the one we wished to proceed with, and then to develop that to a proposal we could take to the Oxford City Council, a city council that was deeply divided on whether what they were seeing was the very best vision for the future of Oxford, one of Britain's most famous architects doing a design right here, or a violation of all of the protection orders around the North Oxford Conservation Zone, defined as it is by its boring Victorian architecture, but its very beautiful mature trees. And in the end, it was down to the casting vote of the chairman of the planning committee that decided that this building would get the green light to go ahead. This was followed by the financial crisis, which meant that our donors were not in a position to fulfill their plans to pay for the building. And that delayed things by another 3 years. And then we finally were able to resume, take it out to tender. Tender came back at a price that went well beyond what any of us had ever budgeted for doing this building. There was a value engineering exercise. In this way, a project that we had hoped might be 2 or 3 years for a small building in North Oxford went on for 9 years. But it was for that reason, such a joyful occasion to welcome Zaha to the building. She'd been on site 2 or 3 times during the construction period of the building and before for her to come. She even was positive about the building, which wasn't always something you could count on. Though she did have critical things to say about the furniture we'd chosen for the archive and for the library. She had curved architecture in mind for those spaces too. And so she came away looking happy with the finishing, with the design, with the building. And all I can say 10 years later is we still are. If one were to say that her buildings in some way were more about the form than about the function, all I can say is that this building for 10 years has excited, it's succeeded to our wildest expectations. They were pretty wild. In delivering a program that has transformed our community, the Middle East Center, with this lecture theater, with the meeting spaces on the gallery floor above us, with an absolutely stunning library that set a new standard for the whole of the University of Oxford, and truly one of the best archives that you will find in the United Kingdom in terms of its commitment to providing both the best space for readers and the best space for the conservation of photographs and of papers. Truly a building that, however beautiful its outside, is just 110% delivering on the function that we had hoped for. So we decided, as the building approached its 10th anniversary, that we should mark the occasion and have a couple of lectures by those who knew Zaha, those who were, you know, involved in her practice and could in some way capture the magic that Zaha Hadid brought to the world of architecture, and of which this building that you are in today is a vital part of her legacy, one that we are very committed to preserving and celebrating in all ways that we can. And so as part of that, we thought that we would try to reintroduce Zaha to this building that she was in, as I said, 10 days short of 10 years ago, by bringing some original artwork from her architectural practice as well as from her friends. And in making that happen, I just want to extend my thanks to the Zaha Hadid Foundation, who have been absolutely wonderful in indulging us in the dream of exhibiting original works from the practice of Zaha Hadid. I'd like to, it's been a whole year in the coming, and there's been a change of personnel, but this started a conversation with Leonora Baird-Smith, who was the previous head of collections, and I'd like to welcome Helen Merritt, who is current head of collections at Zaha Hadid Foundation. Again, Jane Pavitt, who was the previous head of research and learning, and Dr. Catherine Howard, the research officer. I'd like to express particular thanks to Rosie Martyr and Phil Sofer, exhibitions and art handling, for all of their hard work in seeing us through the paperwork and then actually seeing the works delivered here and hung in position. And I'm sure you all noticed it coming in, but take the time to dwell over the work heading out. We're very grateful to the Zaha Hadid Foundation and hope this is the beginning of an ongoing collaboration between the Foundation and St. Anthony's College. So, let us not forget everyone at St. Anthony's who helped make this happen. I had no idea how complicated it is to borrow a couple of artworks by a world-famous creator through their foundation. But it involves a lot of paperwork and insurance and a great deal of correspondence. And in so doing, I'm afraid I put a lot of burden on a lot of colleagues. So let me please extend my warmest thanks to my St. Anthony's colleague, starting with our librarian, Amy Gulakova. Amy has taken over the role of archive management and in that sense overseeing the gift and loan of artwork. I don't think that Amy had any idea what she was getting into when she accepted that extension as her job as college librarian. But then neither did Debbie Ushwood, who is our Middle East Center archivist and who has helped with every step of assisting with the environmental conditions and in, again, advising on the paperwork, even signing off on the receipt of the art as it came in. I would like to extend thanks to Gordon Patterson, our maintenance manager, who's been an absolute prince in ensuring that the artwork could be installed yesterday. It's a big scaffold you have to assemble. You have to have responsible hands on hand to actually hang the work. I would like to thank Dagny Matsonson, our head of operations and estates, our college bursar, Tanya Baldwin, but most of all, the person who seems to connect all of us and get it all done with an efficiency and a lightheartedness that inspires us all. I'd like to thank Jenny Williams. But then there's a third painting out there, in addition to the two we have that are, well, there's a card, a montage, and there is an acrylic, both of the Rosenthal Center for Contemporary Arts in Cincinnati. There's a very long original painting by Zaha. And I would like to thank its owner, who has loaned it to us, Michael Wolfson and Maxim Milov. And while I'm at it, I might as well go on to introduce you. Michael Wolfson is an architect and an artist who left the Cornell School of Architecture in 1978 to continue his studies on what he intended to be a year abroad at the AA here in London, the Architects Association. But having come here, having spent a year studying with, among others, a relative junior member of faculty named Zaha Hadid, he decided to abandon Cornell and finish his architecture studies at the AA in 1982. And on his graduation, Zaha invited her student to work with her. And from 1982, right through to the end of the decade, Michael worked with Zaha as lead designer on a full-time basis, involved in some of the landmark early projects that were really to establish Zaha's name in the world of architecture. In 1991, Michael opened his own interior architecture studio, but continued his work with Zaha on a sort of occasional basis, in which role in the 1990s and the early 2000s, he was one of the collaborators on the Rosenthal Center itself. So very lovely to have those two pieces in particular alongside your own painting, Michael. He's practiced as an architect and a sculptor since opening his own interior architecture studio in 1991. He exhibits his work at international art fairs, and his works are held in several museums around the world. And he serves as the judge on the Tomatoes Award for Art and Architecture. I cannot think of anyone, because of their proximity to Zaha and their engagement with her work and ideas, better to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the opening. Will you please join me in extending the warmest of welcomes? Unlike a lightning strike, this overview of the early works of Zaha Hadid and her studio, and some of what inspired it, won't harm you. However, if you did happen to be around her, she most probably did affect all of your senses quite profoundly. In particular, it was Zaha Hadid who struck me with a bolt of lightning. Outside of nature, lightning strikes can be likened to revolutions, either of culture or industry or society. In the 20th century, these bolts illuminated the world, and the ensuing effects were felt through all of the arts. It was the ideas generated from the movements in Russia that were of particular inspiration to Zaha, architecturally, socially, and programmatically. There was a looking forward to a better future. The spiral form, whether it be a golden ratio or logarithmic spiral, Archimedean or Fibonacci, embraces a movement that we will see echoing throughout Zaha's work. These early 20th century movements led to a new and contemporary use of the urban landscape, which had an exciting post-World War II flourishing. Works by the Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer were of particular interest, and pretty much every book on his work could be found in Zaha's library. This was the Ibirapuera Park, 1954, and the design of the new capital city of Brasilia by Niemeyer and Lucia Costa. She did have a wonderful trip to Brazil once when she met the man and had a memorable meeting with him at his studio. This is the Breda Pavilion by Luciano Baldassarre, designed for the Milan Trade Fair in 1952, an early use of the formed concrete. Lucia Fontana, neon structure for the Ninth Triennale of Milan in 1951. Mies modernism, by the 1970s, had grown to an unsavory magnitude, but it was what most schools of architecture were adhering to: straight lines, concrete, and glass. By the later part of the last century, art and architecture were in a state of flux. Then there was the AA, the Architectural Association, in London, which by the mid-70s, with the newly appointed director Alvin Boyarsky at its helm, uprooted the norm. It was in the late 70s, and I was fortunate enough, right place, right time, to be at the AA in London. It was a hotbed of new architectural and social changes and ideas, and inspiration was being given by the new breed of thinkers. Hector Sotsas's work with the Memphis Group, Studio Alchemia, Alessandro Nandini, Studio Alchemia again, and my favorite drawing instrument, the French curve, or in France, known as the parakeet, parakeet. This particular example you'll find at Drawing Matter Collection, previously in Somerset, now in Covent Garden. It was the curve that took me through my studies at the AA, and eventually we went with Zaha to Paris and bought up all of the stock and supplied every single person in the office. Those of you in the younger years, this was a tool you had to use by hand, not on a computer, because they weren't invented then. People like Rem Koolhaas, Zaha Hadid, Michael Graves, Frank Gehry, were creating explosions in the way you could approach architecture and design. Curves were back with a vengeance. Painting became a part of the architectural storytelling. This is Madeleine Vriesendorp and Zoe Zengales, who both worked with OMA, the Office of Metropolitan Architecture, and painting, which was bordering on a surrealist abstraction rather than an architectural description. Manhattan Grid, OMA. As a student of Rem Koolhaas, Ilya Zengales, and Ilya Zengales, Zaha was carrying out works as a student, such as a Malevich tectonic, interpreted as an architectural proposal over the Thames River, and her Museum of the 19th Century. When Zaha graduated, she was invited to partner with Rem and Ilya at OMA, working on the Dutch Parliament extension of The Hague in 1978-1979. The story there, I assume, we'll find out one of these days. I've heard a few amusing anecdotes as to Zaha's. Well, let's just say she was more amicable to being in control rather than being told what to do. In any case, her time with OMA didn't last long, and she needed her own orbit. So setting up on her own in 1980, she submitted a design for the Irish Prime Minister's residence competition. These are sketches from her notebook. This is 1979, 1980, the Irish Prime Minister's residence competition. And you can see her influence of the forms in the proposal. In 1980-81, Zaha worked on the design for her brother's house at 59 Eaton Place, London. An explosion, again, which didn't happen. The use of the isometric drawing style, the axonometric, the way the plans were drawn, a bird's eye view perspective of the bathroom. Again, an isometric drawing. These works were being published at the time by some of the smaller UK and international magazines and journals. And we, as students, religiously devoured all of them. And it was in 1981 that I joined Zaha's unit, Studio 9 at the Architectural Association. I later learned it was her first year of teaching her own unit at the AA, and this without anyone working with her. So drawings were put up on the wall, laid out on the floor, on the table, and everyone was describing their designs to Zaha. She listened, and then often exploded. But these explosions were, for the most part, her way of getting us to push ourselves further. But in the end, the output was exponentially amazing. It was with this fifth year project of mine that I had an amazing tutorial with Zaha. She wasn't my tutor that fifth year. She was my tutor in my fourth year. But I went to her, and she sat with me for about an hour, and I don't remember what we argued about, but there was a lot of arguing. And it was quite exceptional, because all I remember is that relatively soon afterwards, it was when she asked me if I wanted to work with her when I graduated. And I did graduate. And in 1982, when I graduated, Zaha asked me to work with her in her
little teeny-weeny muse house in South Kensington, and its focus is just the single window there. There was not a third floor at the time. It was two floors, basically a room you walked into, a kitchen, a room upstairs, and a dressing room. And that's where we had the office. There was another recent graduate, Alistair Standing, but it wasn't all work there. you can see the little staircase going up. I think that's me. And that's all. She designed all of her own clothes at the time. So it was in that summer of 1982 that the three of us, me, Zaha, and Alistair Standing, started on the design of the Peak Project competition. This was an international competition for the top of the mountain in Hong Kong, the Peak. The winning entry, which was this one, was a series of horizontal slabs. This was the sketch that Zaha did that I remember when we walked into the studio that summer to start working on it. And Zaha's little sketches were incredibly inspirational to me, and certainly. You could see there was so much in it, and this was the one that really set the tone for our work on the Peak. One of the early sectional studies. It ate into the mountain. You had a series of beams, which were residential units. The open section in the middle was the more public component for the members of the club, and into the mountainside were the health club, the swimming pool, and gym, and that sort of thing. One of the interesting things about the project and about all of Zaha's work was that there was always this idea that the public were meant to enjoy something about it, whether you were involved in it or not. And with the Peak, this is everyone in Hong Kong used to go up to the top of the Peak on certain days of the year, but it was all closed off. They were all private houses and apartments, so you never got a view. Zaha's idea with this project was to open up that section as you're walking up so that you could see through and get the view, so that anyone walking through could see through and get to the view. This was one of the ideas that we laid out for the lower levels of the apartments. Early sketch showing the beams, and one of the beams was a swimming pool. And then the jagged bit is the bit that goes into the mountain and held the health club. This was the breakdown that was part of the competition brief. Every floor had a square footage that was determined. The breakdown of the sections and the plans. So that was one of the drawings that was submitted for the competition. So you can see how, you know, the axonometric view. These were the plans, the sectional drawings, again, part of the competition submission. This was what we referred to as a working drawing of the sorts. And then the more abstract perspectives. One of the things that I'm very proud of and my involvement with Zaha was that I was the one to introduce the abstracted perspective, because I think Zaha's work before was about axonometric and isometric, and there were no perspectives done. It was something that I think I'd learned at Cornell and worked on in my projects at the AA. But the distortion that I gave the perspectives, I think Zaha admired, and it was a way of adding that component of speed and movement to the designs. This was a view looking into the health club, the indoor pool. You can see the difference when they're the line drawing, the painted perspective. That's the overall floor plan. The curve is the road going up to the top of the mountain. Again, overview. This was the set of plans that was submitted. And then part of the notes. Interestingly, I think it's important what Zaha wrote here, the last paragraph. The final criterion is a composite and total of all of these programmatic beams looking over the mountainside, and these suspended satellites constitute a modern geology. This was one of the painted views of the beam. So the lower beams were units that were to be sold or rented. The public component was the health club, open air, library, swimming pool, restaurant in the middle. The top two beams were for the penthouse, the promoter's family on the beam below the top, and the very top beam was for the promoter, the developer himself. This was one of the models. View from the road, and then the driveway leading into the building. View from below, again, black and white, painted. View from the sort of beam area. So that's the library without the skin and the lap pool beam. This was the painting called The Divers. I think it's the only drawing that Zaha ever had with people in it. And the painted version. You might call it slightly abstract. This was from the level looking at the side of the pool beam, which had little changing cabanas. That's the view from the library overlooking the landscape. There were buildings and there were trees, and we chose not to show them. The upper level penthouse, which was the developer's penthouse and pool, which then flowed down to the developer's family who lived in the beam below and their pool. Overview from the mountain. Now, we won the competition, so I was thrilled, at the beginning of 1983. It was published everywhere. It achieved international notoriety. The head of the AA, Alvin Boyarsky, decided it was time to offer Zaha an exhibition. So we were given the AA to work and draw. We were given the back room upstairs, which was set up as a whole studio for paintings and images to be carried out for the exhibition. And that was a publication, Planetary Architecture 2, with a painting called The World. Now, those of you who weren't around then might think that they were computer drawings, but they weren't. They were all done by hand. And this particular drawing, the large one done for the exhibition, was approximately 3+ meters, about the size of the painting out there. So it was laid out a sketch form. It was then hard lined. Then it was unrolled onto blue trace paper, carbon trace paper, transferred onto a large stretched piece of cartridge paper, which was then painted. These are two of the color studies done, A4 size, for the finished peak painting. And that's the final painting. So, unfortunately, many people never saw where the project was because it was sort of hidden in there. So if you look at the very top, you'll see the project, which is there. So look closely and you blink on this. Now, what we did at the bottom over in the bay, we created these slabs, and that's where the floor plans were all put, floating and landing on slabs. At the very bottom of the painting. So it was, you know, there. At the event itself, at the AA, there was a sort of an abstracted model of the swimming pool beam, diagrams laid out on the floor, and a cake was baked in the shape of the peak project. Again, I think that's me there, and Zaha and Alistair. So this was one of the other paintings. A lot of very large scale images were created to show the peak, looking at both how it worked in the day, how it worked at night, examining it. This one was called Confetti. So this is the model that was projecting from the wall. One of the other paintings done for the exhibition was called The World. This was, I believe, the study sketch which Zaha gave me to create the image of the world, which is that, again, another large-scale painting. And the world, she wanted to encapsulate all of the unbuilt projects that she'd done to date, starting with her tectonic over the Thames. And Nikki, yeah, you painted on this, so if I'm wrong, you'll have to make a comment. But it was quite an interesting project to work on. I remember thinking, well, gosh, the world, that's taking a lot, but there you go. We worked in 1983 on another competition, which was in France, in Paris, the La Villette Park. And that proposal encapsulated a lot of layers, which was very, you know, exciting to be playing with. Layers that were fields, layers of movement, picnic layers that could drive around through the park. We didn't win, but it was an exciting project to work on. Also, the Grand Buildings Competition, London, 1985. And this is the project. It was in Trafalgar Square. And the interesting thing about this project, this is a night and day view, was that Prince Charles had just sort of caused a bit of a commotion by calling the proposal for the extension to the National Gallery a carbuncle. So that scared a lot of people into creating what was then just a sort of a recap of historical architecture. And in the end, that's what was built on this site, the south side of Trafalgar Square. It's just absolutely a remodel of the existing Victorian building that was there. This is a view. There was a ramp that embraced these mini towers that were put onto the site. And the public would have access to this ramp to walk through. The first kind of built project was the interior for Cathcart Road, which was done. It was a wonderful little muse house type building, built probably in the 60s. And the client, through Friends of Zaha's, we were asked to do the interior. Mainly one large studio room on the upper level. And it was there that we created some of the first furniture pieces. These were Zaha's sketches for some of the sofas. So you've got the wave sofa, two coffee tables were made, the whoosh sofa. And that had a hand-painted fabric that was on the seat of the sofa. You can see it there. She called it whoosh. It was sort of done with dots. That's the sperm table, which you can see there, cast bronze. I did not name it that. this was a coat that is at the foundation, painted on linen. Very similar to the linen that the abstract painting out there is painted on. But you can see the forms that she's playing with. Again, the squiggles and the geometry that's moving versions of some of the Russian constructivist forms. So she stated this on the calligraphy of the plan, that she realized there was a connection between the logic of maths in architecture and the abstraction of Arabic calligraphy, and mentioned it in the press as a fertile subject for scholars to investigate. So I don't think it's been investigated thoroughly. We know that calligraphy was a part of her hand. Zaha had incredible hand at drawing, but whether or not she actually meant for Arabic calligraphy to become a design, I don't think she did. this is the painting you can see outside. And there are a lot of interesting forms and movements in it that are paintings on, you know, each detail is a painting in its own right. This is a squiggle that is with the Drawing Matter collection now. Whether it's anything Arabic about it or not, I don't know. Again, this was the work by Ghani Alani. Now, I had a conversation with someone here in the audience tonight, I had wondered whether Zaha knew Ghani Alani. I met someone who's said that he gave her a lesson in summer at some point, but it seems she never went there, but we're not 100% sure. She certainly knew his work. He's one of the Iraqi artists in exile who's living in Paris, still alive today, who's taken calligraphy into an art form and done some amazing works. I found out afterwards with this piece that she's got my name up there, so that supposedly says Michael Wolfson on the top. This was one of the study sketches for the Azabu project. So these were two projects in Tokyo, Azabu and Tomagaya. Azabu was seen as a vertical department store on a miniature site, literally 3 meters wide and about 10 meters deep. So what you're seeing is a view that no one would ever see because it was an internal wall, basically. Again, more sketches for the Azabu. I find them quite inspirational. So the layers and the levels inside the store were done in a way that walking through it was part of the store itself. That's a sort of internal elevation. Again, another internal elevation. That's, you can see how wide it is. That's a working drawing. It did not happen. The other project, Tomagaya, also in Tokyo, was for the developer, it was a showroom for clothes on the raised level and then a workshop below ground. Again, the idea of opening up the ground to the public was something that Zaha was always looking at. So here in the middle of Tokyo, to create this open space on the ground level was something that was not really something that was done very often. Mm-hmm. That was one of the study sketches for Tomagaya. And that's a painting that's, again, a study painting. Again, the ground level, and then you can see the excavation below for the workshops. Images. So, in 86, Zaha was commissioned to do an office building in Berlin, West Germany. So the wall had not fallen. This was also a site that was approximately three meters wide on a corner. So this time the facade was visible. So that's a view of the building. Again, the ground floor open with a ramp up so that people could see what was going on. You could see everything going on at that ground level. There was an exhibition given in Berlin for the drawings and the designs. Two working sort of study perspectives. This was a sort of a study sketch that Zaha did for the elevation. And then, got the wrong drawing in there, sorry. So that's the winning competition. Zaha won. If you're familiar with her work, you'll know about the Cardiff dilemma. This actually predates the Cardiff dilemma. Zaha won this competition. We went to Berlin on a number of occasions, worked with different authorities there. We're working on the working drawings. And then all of a sudden, the project was pulled. And it was built by the second place winner, Helmut Jahn, who's recently deceased, a well-known German, US-based architect, whose second place entry looked nothing like what was designed and built by him in the end. What was built was something that looked very much like Zaha's proposal, which is a shame. But we were getting used to that. Again, all sorts of the images and designs done for the project, a working drawing. And I should note that OVR engineers worked with us from day one. From the peak competition onwards, they were an integral part of every project. Every project could have been built. That's the ground floor, basically, had just this ramp going up into the space. Floor plans. One little project we did was a competition in Abu Dhabi, the Al-Wada Sports Center. That was done in 1987. And then a great honor that Zaha was chosen to be one of the six architects to exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art in New York And this was a show called The Deconstructivist Architecture, which kind of set the tone for the name of what was then referred as Deconstructivist Architecture. Co-op Himmelblau, Peter Eisenman, Frank Gehry, Zaha, Rand Kuhlhaas, and Danny Libeskind. The show itself had a lot of amazing Russian constructivist works, but Malevich and Lissitzky in one space, and then the other were artworks by the architects. You can see it was the Peak Project and La Villette that was exhibited there. That's the model coming out of the wall. Shortly after, there was a company called Swid Powell in New York. We were asked to design a series of plates. So this was called the Beam series. You can see why. And then there was the first major built interior, which the Zaha Foundation did a really lovely exhibition on last year. This was the restaurant in Sapporo, Japan. And it was basically the idea behind it. It was in an existing new building, not by Zaha. And so it was on two floors. And her idea for it was basically fire and ice. That was the lower ground floor entrance, which was about the idea of ice. You can see there was a use of cracked glass, the image of the interiors. And then the ideas for the upper level were based on this sort of squiggles of movements that came in that accelerated from, again, a spiral form that connected the two floors. It was over the bar. And an interesting little drawing done around the same time. And in it, again, she's used Arabic calligraphy to say hello. I don't think it actually influenced the design itself, but again, you've got that idea of the squiggle happening, which is in the project. So then there's the West German projects. Again, this is the Zollhof Media Park in Dusseldorf. Not built, but a series, again, of an open ground plane. So you have this Docklands area in Dusseldorf. Streets that were blocked from the water, you couldn't see a view. Zaha's idea was to open up that ground plane so that people walking through could go out to the water and then create, instead of along the street, a series of buildings that intersected to create this sort of series of openings and events. Again, that's the view from the water. And the whole ground plane was opened and sculpted. And then the IBA social housing. So not that well known, but it was the first of the two projects that were built, actually built architecturally. This was, at the time, the West German government sponsored a lot of international architects to do social housing in Berlin. Germany, and Zaha was given a site near the wall, near Checkpoint Charlie, and it was a sort of triangulated site. So the idea was really to build, instead of what they wanted, which was a standardized four-floor blob, she said, no, we're going to do a tower on the corner of the wedge, and then we'll just lower the bit to make the housing and the shops on the rest of the site. And she got it through. So the tower had, I think, two or three units in it, and it wasn't that huge a tower, I think 8 floors. But it was built, and these are some of the study sketches for the forms of the space itself. And what's really sort of sad is that Zaha got scared because this was going to be her first building. And we had a really committed contact architect in Berlin working on it, who was really trying to do everything. But it was social housing, so you had a limited budget. And I think she got scared that it wouldn't be completed to her satisfaction. So at a certain point, she sort of washed her hands of the project, didn't want to talk about it, and just sort of closed her eyes and thought, well, let's go on, because another project had come into the office. I heard afterwards that, in fact, it's been considered one of the best of the IBA projects. So you can see this was one of the ideas we were looking at as of developing the design. That's how it was completed. So for social housing, I think they did a pretty darn good job of getting it to look like Zaha was intending it to look. Again, the study sketch, I think they were able to get some sort of a zinc clad aluminium panels to cover it. I never saw the building completed up close, but I do remember I was in Berlin once after the fall of the wall, before they built onto the no man's land, and I remember walking through the Brandenburg Gate, and I looked back and where Checkpoint Charlie was, I said, wait a minute, the building should be there, and yes, you could see this prow of the building sort of sticking over the no man's land. So the final project, which I wasn't involved in, but this was seen as Zaha's first project, which is Vitra Fire Station. It is in Germany. It's in Weil am Rhein. So quite interesting that all of the first buildings were done in Germany. And maybe there's a whole history to be looked at there, because it was West Germany. This was in the 80s and 90s. So you've got this group of post-war babies that have come to fruition, and they're wanting something new. They embraced Zaha before a lot of other countries did. So I went on to, after the Vitra, after the IBA project, I set up my own studio. And as you can see, my influence was obviously very much Zaha. This is my origami series. This was done for a gallery, a Pro-Lam gallery. Sound form series that I was playing with, Sound Notes, Liquid Genesis, which was done for Glenmorangie. The Twisted series, and then the D-Line series, which was carbon fiber, about the movement of a pencil line, those pieces. And then this is a sculptural piece in Vortex DNA. So the origami dancers are the latest sculptures I've been working on, and you can see one of them outside here in the entrance hall. It's very funny, you're all here because of a series of coincidences. And I'm going to briefly tell you, and then I will shut up. So last year, I have a rather grand cousin who has a museum in Florida and in Genoa, and he was very close to Zaha. So Mickey Wolfson is his name. Mickey was coming to London, to Oxford, and he said, Max and Michael, meet me at Heathrow. Pick me up, drive me to Oxford, where I'm going to the opera, and we'll have a wonderful day. So I said, being the dutiful cousin, I said, of course, Mickey. We picked Mickey up at Oxford, at Heathrow, drove slowly through the traffic of the Henley Regatta, got to Oxford, had a lovely lunch, went to the Ashmolean, went to the Pitt Rivers. I'd organized a dinner, but we had a couple of hours to kill. And I thought, wait a minute, Zaha's done a building in Oxford, and I've never seen it. Mickey, would you like to go? Max, would you like to go? Yes, yes. So we find it. And we look, and this is stunning. And we're thinking, well, well. So we got out of the car and knocked on the window, because there's no obvious entry. And one of your students very politely let us in. So we're looking around. I see a woman coming down with a mug of tea in her hand. And I say, excuse me, would you tell us anything? I happen to have worked with Zaha for many years. My cousin knew her very well in Miami. This was Carolyn, the assistant, one of the assistant and directors and
tells me everything.
Administrators. She then proceeded to spend the next 3 hours giving us a tour of the building from top to bottom. So that was the first coincidence. The next day, she tells the director, I met this interesting person who worked with Zaha. That next day, one of the official biographers of Zaha was here to interview the director, Eugene Rogan, who I knew, because I'd met her a number of times. She'd interviewed me, and I'd had dinner with her in New York because she's a friend and lives in the same building as a dear friend of mine. What are the chances? So she says, oh yes, Michael Wolfson, he's real. So Eugene says, well, I have to talk to him, and calls me and comes out to visit us in Epping and says, well, you have to come and talk.
Yeah.
And so we're here. You're here. And thank you very much for listening.
Yay.